Zoe, can you hear me? Can you ask a question? Okay, it's Zoe's question. I'm sorry about the problems with the technical side. I apologize for that. Zoe's question is, have you already reached out to congressional members and the EPA about your recommendations for strengthening the Clean Water Act? If so, what has been the response? If not, are you sending them your report? What are our next moves? Anyone want to tackle that question? Eric, do you want to try that one? Well, what are we doing next about this?
In September, last September, we did send the agency a letter which listed all the industrial source categories that were the standards, the wastewater improvement standards, hadn't been updated since the, as far back as the late 70s for some source categories. I'm talking about really big dischargers here. And our letter essentially said, really, you know, these need to be periodically updated. It's one thing to miss a five-year deadline, and, you know, so maybe it's 7 years or 8 years because the agency's got limited resources and lots to do. But that seemed really extreme. And the answer we got was, you know, thank you for your views. We do plan some follow-up there. I just think that's an area where the system is kind of broken down and these rules just don't get the tune-up that they're supposed to. And you can see looking at some of the data that you get a really pretty big reduction from some of these categories if they could do what the more advanced plants in that industry, if all of them were made to like conform to that standard, you get some results. So that's an area that we have put in front of the agency. We don't really have an exciting response yet, but it's an area that we're going to continue to push. And we will share the report. I should add that Keene, in his research, spent a lot of time emailing back and forth with state agencies to make sure that, you know, we understood the data, we had the latest information. We spent a lot of time with them. And of course, we'll be sending them the final version as well.
Our next question comes from Amy Joy. Amy, what publication are you from? And tell us your question.
I work for the Deseret News in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Great, go ahead.
My question is this. I noticed that Utah came in among the top three worst states for the percentage of streams and rivers that are listed as impaired for aquatic life. And so I just wanted to I'm sorry, in the slideshow, it said nine. There was like a number nine next to that. And I just wanted to make sure I understood the context of that number nine. And also if the analyst determined if it was like, it was mentioned that Oregon's rivers were overheated. And I'm thinking it's probably nutrient pollution in our state.
Anyone want to answer that question? Keen?
Yeah, I can start it off. So looking at Utah's integrated report that we used, they list the top parameters that the waterway was impaired for by count. They don't actually list it by stream miles in the report. And it looks like right now they have dissolved oxygen temperature or pH as the highest category. Followed by inorganics, then metals, E. coli, and then so on. There is more accurate information that I'd probably be able to obtain from EPA's Attains web services. And so we can hook up after this call and I can try to grab that information for you as well.
Yeah, Amy, go ahead and send me an email to tpelton@environmentalintegrity.org and I'll connect you and Keene and maybe you can exchange links and you can read yourself some of this causation. Go ahead, Eric.
I was just going to say dissolved oxygen sometimes is a proxy for nutrients. Dissolved oxygen is if the levels are, you know, start to drop, if you don't have enough oxygen in the water, that is a nutrient driven phenomenon. That's not the only reason, but it could be that they're using that as their primary marker for pollution that is mostly nutrients.
Can I ask a quick follow-up?
Sure.
So does that Utah Integrated Report, is that where you find the percentage of assessment that's been done on waterways, or is that in your own report?
So Utah's data ended up coming from a variety of sources to determine the impairments by designated use. I did use EPA's Attains Web Services database to figure that out. As far as overall impairments go, and some of those state numbers, I believe it was through emails with an employee at the State Environmental Agency office is how I got those numbers. Utah's integrated report has useful information. It's just some of it isn't presented in miles and acres. And so I ended up having to follow up with some people there.
Yeah, because I'll ask this of our water quality director, but I'm wondering if Utah got that high ranking because the agency did reach out and voluntarily start assessing waterways from the headstream in watersheds in our state. So they went out and started doing that in a pretty aggressive manner. But I'll talk to them about that. Thank you for your time.
Okay, our next question comes from Jack Uchoni, and Jack asks, to what degree are the federal monies followed and by who? What is done to make sure it gets to the correct people as targeted? What agencies keep the states accountable? Eric, do you want to try ask that question about accountability? How does the federal government hold states accountable or not?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question that I don't have a lot of depth on. I feel like that would have been a good thing to look into. I know that usually the construction grant money is distributed, and I'm sorry, that's the construction grant money is for wastewater treatment. There is a similar program for drinking water plants. So there are two big funds. Those are used to actually to stimulate bond markets. So they're put in a revolving fund. And for a number of years now, that money goes out to anchor a loan that will be repaid over a long period of time. And when that funding, when those loans are gradually repaid, that's used to replenish the trust fund. So that funding is distributed to states by formula. There's less congressional earmarking than there used to be, saying this city has to get this much and this county has to get that much. You don't generally see that anymore. That doesn't mean representatives aren't leaning on the agency, but I think after EPA does the allocation, there's back and forth with the state, but I think it's primarily the state that does the actual distribution, but I'm not confident of that. And as to accountability, I mean, you know, but I think your larger question is, how do you know it's getting to the right places? And the short answer is, I don't really know. And maybe I should just stop there for once and, you know, not try to extemporize too much.
Our next question comes from Kevin Speer, a reporter at the Orlando Sentinel in Florida. Kevin, can you unmute your mic and ask your question?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Go ahead.
Yeah, I am about to write a story about a very high level of microcystin found in a residential lake that's abutted by some very nice winter park in Orlando neighborhoods. And I've seen over the years that people will move into Florida and happily live next to an impaired lake as long as it provides scenery. But I think the introduction of toxic algae might be a game changer in storytelling, for me anyway. How much of a driver is harmful algae or toxic algae in Clean Water Act discussions?
Anyone want to answer a question about the importance of toxic algae these days?
I'll jump in and help Eric out because I know he's been doing a lot of the heavy lifting. But certainly toxic algae is a really big point of conversation in Louisiana. I grew up in Florida, so I'm kind of familiar with that area. One of the biggest concerns is that, yes, we have seen improvement in our analytical capabilities. That threshold or the recreational water quality criteria for that particular contaminant was just published and approved in 2019. So it's a relatively new set of criteria to work with as far as what constitutes safe and what constitutes impaired. I think from a state standpoint, it's going to be challenging to find and incorporate those criteria from the standpoint that just a few years ago, these analytical techniques were only available at an academic level. They weren't available at a commercial laboratory level. So there is a lot of quality assurance and quality control considerations that go into implementing that parameter into testing routines. And even though toxic algae has been something we've been talking about as far as fisheries here in Louisiana, by and large, that hasn't been incorporated into LDEQ's assessment for waterways under the Clean Water Act as of now. But I certainly see that coming in the near future.
So I understand Kevin's point about the earlier point about you want to be near the scenic lake. Algae is visible and gross and can be dangerous. And Dr. Skaggs explained that really well. But I think something else we need is if you're on beaches, federal law requires warnings whenever the bacteria levels make the water unsafe for swimming. People would be shocked to understand how often that's true of freshwaters that they're splashing around in, but there's no federal requirement to provide notice. So if you're thinking about Floridians moving to an area, getting warned that pretty lake in their backyard has too much bacteria and that it's unsafe for them to go in or their children to go in, even though the lake looks good, I think that would have an impact. I think that's something we could add to the mix, not to scare people needlessly, but when the bacteria is too high, people should know. And they'd have the right to jump in if they wanted to, but I think that would get people thinking about the kind of changes to water quality that we need.
Our next question is from Jenny Staltovich. Jenny, please unmute yourself and tell us what publication you're from and what your question is. Can you unmute yourself?
Tom, sorry, she ended up following up later on. She had to jump off. She's going to follow up.
Oh, she had to jump off. Okay. All right, then. So it sounds like your question was answered. Our next question is from Hannah Northey from E&E News Service. And Hannah, can you unmute yourself and ask your question?
Yeah. Hi. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes, go ahead.
Great. My first question is about this ag loophole, and I guess it goes along with other non-point sources of pollution. I'm seeing bills out there, like I just looked this up, and I see that there are pieces of legislation to address this, like Democratic House bills. I'm just wondering why this hasn't been addressed before. I mean, why is this a long, if I talk to authors of the Clean Water Act and I ask them, why is this in here? I guess I'm just wondering, like, over the decades, why it hasn't been addressed. And then similarly, talking about this technology-based limits for water pollution control systems, last time I wrote about the last letter that was sent about this to EPA, one former EPA official told me it just hasn't been a priority at the agency. Can you kind of illuminate me as to why hasn't that been addressed?
Eric Schaefer, could you tackle that technology-based limits question?
So again, the confined animal feedlots where you have lots of animals, you have to have a certain number be over that threshold. There are permit requirements. They just haven't been implemented well. There are some legal issues that could be, the statute could have been written a little better, but there is something there in the statute to work with. Bluntly speaking, the state legislators in particular do not want farmers regulated. It is in my state of Maryland, where you've got maybe 10% of the legislators from rural areas with poultry operations of any size. 90% of them come, they're either urban, suburban, or sort of outer ring developments. You can't really get significant legislation through that cracks down on what we know is a repeated problem on the Eastern Shore. I think part of the problem is that people who are operating those farms aren't necessarily making a lot of money. The people who make the money, and I don't want to get in a soapbox, but it is true, are the so-called integrators, the corporations that provide them with the baby chicks, the recipe for raising them, really manage the operator under a very tight contract, but walk away from the waste problem. And they have the money. If we look at their income levels, we're talking about very, very big companies. So we have that issue. I think maybe if you're asking about the statute, the problem was not as severe. That's the scenario where I think the problem's gotten worse. In 1972, there were a lot fewer people, and we still had a lot of farms where you had a mix of some livestock, lots of crops, enough land to pasture animals or spread the manure on crops that could take it up. When you get into this, lots and lots of animals on very small amounts of land, you've got a problem. And since then, of course, with ethanol subsidies, we've gone to monoculture corn in huge, we're like the planet corn. If you drive through parts of the Midwest, there's more of that than there used to be. And that's a crop that depends on heavy use of fertilizer. So the statute in that way hasn't kept up. I know others have worked these ag issues again on the front line, Indra or Maria. If I missed anything or you want to add anything.
You're muted, Maria. Unmute yourself.
I'm sorry. No, I think that you have it covered. There are ways within the act, like you said. And as a matter of fact, like Delaware is a perfect example. They are a state, you know, that has adopted these ways to permit, but they are way behind in permitting. And truth be told, it's hard to even get information. This is how well they're protected. I mean, under the Freedom of Information Act, I've had Attorney General's decision, you know, against the agency. It is very well protected, and that, I don't know how to say that in a nicer way, but that's a problem, right? Because they are an industry that creates a lot of waste. You heard in the report that the majority of waste was from agriculture. So for them to be exempt from what every other industry has to fall under the regulations it's very problematic. And, you know, we talk about the Clean Water Act 50 years ago. Farming looked a lot different 50 years ago, right, than it does today. The operations have gotten very, very large. I have operations literally in some states where the barns are over 700 feet long. Think about that for one barn. And these have 20 barns on it. This is not so much your small farmer anymore. If each poultry barn costs $400,000 to build, multiply that by 20 and you tell me what family farmer has that kind of money. We need to really look at this, and that's the truth from on the ground.
Another good question from Anonymous. The question is, are there any standards or regulations that states must follow when reporting water quality data? Or is it largely up to the state's discretion? I don't know if Eric or Keen wants to try a response to that one.
Maybe Keen, in terms of what you ran into trying to rationalize the state data.
One thing I would suggest for everyone who's reading this report is to check out I believe it's Appendix A, which covers some of the data limitations of the report.
I think that's Appendix B, yes.
Appendix B, thank you. That covers some of the data limitations on, you know, trying to make these kinds of comparisons, because states do different things in all aspects of this, of water monitoring. They have different requirements for what is included in their assessments, you know, so there are certain states that only monitor water quality at lakes of a certain size, while other states look at everything. There are certain states that only look at perennial waterways, and others that look at all of their waterways, including ephemeral and intermittent streams. But to the question of standards or regulation, they can take EPA guidance and then choose how they want to implement that within their water quality monitoring plans. An example that we include at the bottom of our report is, let me pull it up for a second. Sorry, wrong page. But with Maryland and Virginia, they use the same threshold for when they're measuring for bacteria in the waterways. But the way they implement that threshold is quite different. Virginia measures 90-day periods over a six-year time frame, and Maryland measures one or two exceedances over 10 years of data that happened in two consecutive years. So it gets pretty complicated. And so I would, like, for your specific state, if you're interested, I would encourage looking at their specific water quality standards, but they vary widely across all states.
This is a weakness of the Clean Water Act. If you want to know whether there's too much smog, whether you violated the ozone standard in Texas or Maryland or California, you use the same standard. There's a federal standard in parts per billion for a handful of really significant pollutants. There are lots of pollutants in waterways. I understand why they can't do it for all of them, but I do think for nutrients, for example, getting common measures that are used from one state to the next would really help, especially because a lot of this pollution has to be managed on a watershed basis. And you really need to know how you're doing, even in the Chesapeake Bay, which has been, you talk about like beating the watershed approach to death for 30 years. We don't measure nutrients the same way from one state to the next. It's, you know, you can kind of get there, you can sort of do the translation, but why? And of course, it makes it hard for the public to understand what's going on. So getting a handful of pollutants, bacteria, nutrients, and just have a common metric for those across the country would really help.
Our next question is from Hallie Parker. Hallie, why don't you unmute yourself and ask your question? Also, let us know what publication you're from.
Hi, yeah, I'm from New Orleans Public Radio. And obviously agriculture is also an issue here, but it's also home sewage treatment systems that are in rural areas that leak and impair our waterways. And I was just wondering if I could get y'all's perspective on how this could be helped from a federal level and whether it's being considered, and just whether home sewage treatment systems are a problem in other states as well, or if this is a uniquely Louisiana problem.
Dr. Skaggs,
Well, I do know that on-site wastewater treatment systems are certainly utilized in a lot of different areas. And even the ATUs that we have here in Louisiana are used in a state like Washington. Now, I can't answer whether or not they require chlorination, but our state does not require that. So that is certainly one of the causes for impairments as far as fecal coliform to our swimmable waterways.
Anyone else want to try an answer to that one?
Septic systems have been a big problem in Maryland, both for groundwater, but also because they're located near rivers and streams. The groundwater runs into the river and stream, taking contamination from the septic with it. The state's spent a lot of money, both imposed requirements and provided funding to overhaul those. So I think it's more than just Louisiana.
All right, we are coming up on the hour and a half mark, which is 30 minutes more than we had budgeted, but the questions were so good. I'm glad everyone had the chance to stick around and answer questions. If you have any more questions, feel free to call me, Tom Pelton, at 443-510-2574, or send me an email to tpelton, T-P-E-L-T-O-N, at environmentalintegrity.org. I'll be vigilant, getting right back to you today. Also, the report is posted on our website, www.environmentalintegrity.org. Check it out. And we also have, of course, a searchable spreadsheet of data that our analyst Keen Kelderman put together that's available for every single state, all different types of water bodies. So that's a good tool for any reporter doing a state-level story on this subject. I want to thank everyone once again for your time and for all the great questions. We have reporters from all over the country today, and I'm really glad we had a dialogue that really had a national perspective. Thank you very much, and have a great afternoon.